This podcast is brought to you by Mark Dawson's Facebook Ads for Authors course. It's open for enrollment right now. This online instructional video tutorial course is getting results and changing authors' lives.
Since starting, my income has tripled.
It just worked wonders.
Immediately. I think within the first day, my sales just started jumping and jumping and jumping.
Like in December, I think I made $1,100 profit. But this month, I'm probably going to make $8,000, maybe $7,500. It's changed my life.
It's completely changed my life.
There's plenty out there that says it can't be done. You're screwed. You'll never make a dime. You'll never sell your book. Nobody will, there's all of that out there. So it was great to find a positive voice with a strategic and very detailed tactical plan to get all that done.
Everything that I looked at was garbage until I saw Mark's course.
Go to selfpublishingformula.com/Facebook for more info and to enroll. Enrollment will close on the 13th of June, 2016. Hello, and welcome to podcast number 16 from the Self-Publishing Formula.
Two writers, one just starting out, the other a bestseller. Join James Blatch and Mark Dawson and their amazing guests as they discuss how you can make a living telling stories. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Yes, hello. Welcome to the Self-Publishing Formula podcast with James Blatch and Mark Dawson. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good afternoon, James.
Good afternoon. I have no idea. We've had such a busy week. I have no idea what time of day it is.
I don't know where I am.
No, I'm not entirely sure.
I think I'm in Salisbury, but I wouldn't lay money on it.
But it's been great. We've had a very, very busy few days. The course is open and taking on students at a great rate. We've had hundreds of students sign up for the premium course. We've been doing webinars, and it's been very exciting, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, it's always it's always quite nervous when you open the course for the first, for the next time. You don't know quite what response you're going to get, but we've been really taken aback by how many people want to learn how to do this. It's been really flattering. And the Mastery Facebook group, which is where all the students hang out, has been just buzzing with activity. Some really, really great messages going on in there. Some good learning being exchanged right now. And I think students will be about ready to start testing their ads out quite soon. So that's really, really exciting.
Yeah, there was definitely lots of enthusiasm for the course launch beforehand, and that's been realised now. And people who've got some books and got some campaigning going are now looking at doing a new sort of refreshed approach to it. And other people who are starting out really setting themselves up for commercial success are digging into the detail. And it is a detailed course. You know, I spent a bit of time going through it, as you know, Mark. We refreshed it a bit with some new screen flows and a little bit of a new colour and rebranding. And the detail, I have to say, I'm plugging my own course because I'm part of the SPF, but the detail is absorbing. It's quite gripping watching it, seeing how, and that's, I think, our advantage with this course. There are a lot of courses that you can get on social media advertising, and I've done a few of them because I've done a Twitter module and YouTube ads module is on its way. And they're disappointing when they get to that point where they say, you may want to fill this in if you think that's going to be good for your audience, or you may want to do this. Whereas what you say is, don't do that, do this. Very specific for selling books for authors.
Yeah, that's right. And the clue is in the title of the course. It's Facebook Ads for Authors. It's not Facebook Ads for real estate agents or attorneys. It's for writers. You know, that's what I am. So I, when I did the course, I did it with clear focus on what would be useful for where I would have been 2 years ago, what I would have loved to have known, which would have saved me time and effort and money. So yeah, that's it's good to hear you say that. And we've had lots of comments from students who kind of feel that way too. So that's always very, really nice to hear.
Good. And everyone likes our professional approach. And I have now shut my mail down, so you're not going to get another beep over you talking, because we are professionals here. Okay, right. Let's move on to our featured interview for today. So her name is Claire McIntosh. She lives in the United Kingdom. She's a former police detective. She's not the only former police detective we've spoken to on this podcast, who's now turned to thriller writing. Her book, I'm getting famous for getting book titles wrong during interviews. And I think I did again with her sequel. But her first book, I Let You Go, was her big breakthrough. It's been lauded around the world. It's been a bestseller in the United Kingdom. She's breaking it into the States at the moment. So let's listen to Claire and hear about her journey.
Hi,
So, Claire McIntosh. Now, you might remember at the London Book Fair that we bumped into a member of the SPF community called Dan, who is an ex-CID detective. What CID? I suppose the FBI type equivalent in the UK that investigates serious crimes. And he'd turned his hand to writing police procedurals. No surprise. He's not the only one, because one of the more famous ex-policemen now writing is Claire McIntosh, who we're joined by today. And Claire, you were also CID. You also got to that point, I think, when the job became a little bit overwhelming. And I sense that there was a writer in you always struggling to get out, but you've had an absolutely phenomenal last 18 months, haven't you?
I have. It's it's that terrible cliche of talking about this sort of the roller coaster journey that makes you feel a little bit X Factor, but it really has been like that over the last 18 months, couple of years. It's been incredible.
Yeah, and I'll get you to tell your story in a moment, but I know the bare bones of it. I know that you did some freelance articles and magazines, and you had what you described, I think, in an interview once as a mediocre chitlick novel, which which we'll ask you about, but didn't see the light of day, I don't think, yet. But then you wrote...
Well, it definitely won't now.
Oh, won't it? What a shame. I reckon you should subtitle it My Mediocre Chitlit Novel and see how it goes. But you then drew on your experience. You are a policeman. You've dealt with the darker side of life. And I think you've said in interviews in the past that you felt that there was something darker to be written about, and you drew on some real life experiences. The book was called I Let You Go. I mean, you had an agent, I think, with the Chitlit Novel before. So you had some connection with the traditional publishing industry at this stage.
Yep.
Okay, I'm telling you a story here, but so then you picked up an agent, and they realised quite early on that this was a good book. But what I was interested in, and I think people would be interested in now, particularly on the traditional publishing path that you've been on, is that a lot of work went into the book in redrafting and editing. I mean, like 12 months worth of work before it saw the light of day then.
Oh, at least, yeah. I mean, so let me think back. I wrote I Let You Go, wrote the first draft in 2012, I think. And that's when I signed with Curtis Brown, with my literary agent. I did another, at least one, if not two rewrites with the guidance of my agent before it went out on submission in spring 2013. And we sold it in May 2013. And it came out in November 2014. And so we had almost 18 months of editing with my publisher, with my editor at Little Brown. So we went through probably 8 or 9 drafts of the book before it was ready.
Okay. I want to talk to you about that, because I think people would be interested in that process. But let's just quickly say that the book was picked up by no less than Richard and Judy's Book Club. Now, most of our audience are in America, so they don't know who Richard and Judy are. But we should say that they are a married couple who they sort of dominate daytime television in the UK. They're actually a lovely couple, and they're brilliant broadcasters, the pair of them. And they started slightly offbeat, this little book club, a few years back. And it suddenly very quickly became a really important thing in the publishing world. And I was one of those people, a reader, who picked up a Richard and Judy book club recommendation book and didn't put it down. And from then on knew that when that sticker was on a book in a bookshop, it was a really solid recommendation. And I mean, that must have been huge for you when you got that sticker.
Yeah, it was. I mean, they, like you say, they carry huge kudos. They're sort of like the, I don't know, the Oprah, perhaps, yeah. Here in the UK. And, you know, I aspired really to be that sort of book. Not it didn't really sort of occur to me that I might be one of their book club picks, but I certainly wanted to hit that sort of level, that sort of commercial recognition. And so when I found out about 5 months before it was announced, which is quite a long time to keep something secret, it was a huge endorsement. In fact, even before then, when I knew that my publishers were putting me forward for it, because they only put forward 2 or 3 titles from their huge, huge range of books to be considered for the book club, that gave me enormous confidence, because knowing that my publishers sort of felt it was strong enough to be considered was a big, big compliment. And it has undoubtedly changed my life. It set my career on a path that might not have happened without their endorsement.
Well, it was a very strong book. There's no doubt about that. And I'm sure that helped, but it sounds, by the sounds of it, you're going to be a very successful writer regardless. So let's talk about, I'm really interested in the drafting stage, because most of our audience are self-publishers. Some have a foot in both camps. You've gone through that traditional publishing. I mean, it's actually becoming a rarer journey, the one that you've had, I suppose, as publishing changes and transforms over time. But that period then, so what was that like when you had your book, and we all know we have to kill our darlings, et cetera, and go through the editing process, but that sounds quite brutal, what happened.
It was. I suppose out of those 8 drafts, 4 of them, maybe 5, were structural, really big. No, 4 of them, 4 big structural drafts where I literally ripped the entire book apart and wrote it again. You know, I lost subplots, I lost characters, I brought in new themes, new threads. And so those were really, really big. But that still leaves another 4 drafts where it was really about the layers. It was about building more depth to characters and to settings and to themes. And it was about making the twists work. And because there's a twist in I Let You Go, which is sort of slightly unusual and more than the normal sort of, you know, who's the baddie, it relies fairly heavily on language to a certain extent. And so a lot of the drafting process was about linguistically making sure that the book worked. And it was very satisfying because it's, you have to be quite clever about the way you phrase things and how you write them. But it was exhausting, and it was quite demoralizing to know that, you know, I'd sold this book and I should be on cloud 9, but, you know, I didn't actually have anything to show for it. It felt very often as though I was never going to be able to produce a book that was, you know, to the right standard. And I had to keep coming back to what my editor and agent had said after the very first draft. You know, they'd both been really excited about this book. And so I had to keep reminding myself that all I was doing was, I wasn't taking a terrible book and trying to make it good. I was taking a good book and trying to make it even better.
And mission accomplished, and as far as that was going, Claire. Just in terms of putting it into context, so you were still working for the police at that point, I guess?
No, I left the police in 2011 and wrote this book in 2012. And I left predominantly for personal reasons, in that I wasn't being the sort of mother I really wanted to be. I was very much having the career that I wanted to have, but that was at the expense of my children. And I'd been through a rather traumatic time. I'd lost one of my children to meningitis. And so I really needed to reevaluate my priorities. So I left to be at home with them. And writing was something that you said at the beginning that you suspected I'd always been a writer, and I certainly have been, and was probably one of the few police officers that really loved doing paperwork and putting files together. But I'd never sort of thought it could be a career choice. But you know, everyone says, oh, don't give up the day job until you're really sort of making a living from writing. And I did it the other way around. And in my case, it was desperation that enabled me to make a living from it. I had to make a living from writing. It was the only thing I knew how to do that wasn't policing. And it was the only thing I could do from home. And so freelance writing had to pay my mortgage. It had to cover the bills. I couldn't wait for the muse. I couldn't kind of, you know, worry about writer's block. I just had to pitch until I had enough work, you know, to keep a roof over my head.
I suppose, as you said, the editorial process was pretty prolonged for this. That must have been reasonably frustrating, because I guess you just wanted, on the one hand, you wanted to put out the best book that you could. And on the other hand, you wanted to put the book out and hopefully to get it sold. So that must have been quite a frustrating year and a half for you.
Yeah, it really was. And I, you know, I was very conscious of the fact that I'd signed this 2-book deal, that it wasn't a particularly huge deal, and I certainly couldn't live on it. So I was still doing a lot of journalism. And of course, the longer the editing process took, the further away I was from, you know, any money coming in from royalties, the further away I was from another deal after that, and just from sort of building my career. Now, looking back, it all seems like actually a relatively short period of time. And certainly it all worked very well, that kind of slow build. It was all necessary to build my career in the way that it has happened since then. But certainly at the time, it was both frustrating and a worry, a financial worry.
Because, I mean, as the audience members will probably know this, the way that the money is actually is delivered in terms of self-publishing and traditional publishing is very different. So Amazon and the other platforms will typically pay 2 months in arrears on a monthly basis. But, you know, you'll get an advance for a trad deal, which, as you say, might not be, certainly is not always enough to live on. And then you won't see any more money until the book is published. And then you won't see any more money possibly until the next edition is published.
Absolutely. And so you know, the first edition of I Let You Go came out in November 2014. The first royalty statement that had any sort of significance was October 2015.
So almost a year, yeah.
The book writing process you've explained for a bit. In terms of your writing ability, a lot of us think about how to build up to plot twists and so on. So I'm going back a little bit here, but it's the bit that interests me. Plot twists and how to actually take a reader on a journey where it's not very predictable, even if you know everything in your mind that's going to work out. But you're somebody who liked writing. You're somebody who followed real life, obviously, as a policeman. And I'm going to guess you're somebody who's read a lot as well. Did you discover a lot in those 9 months to a year working alongside somebody else of how to actually tell a story as opposed to how you thought a story was told?
Yeah, absolutely. I have learnt so much, and I'm finding now writing, well, having now written my second book and just starting my third, that I wouldn't say I'm finding it easier, just that I'm getting better at writing, which, you know, is unsurprising. If you learn anything for long enough, you will get better at it, one hopes. So I learned a lot about structure and about pace and tension, and somehow knowing something in theory. And I'd read a number of books about writing, and I'd learned about three-act structures, but it's very, very different, I think, reading about that on the page and then actually tearing apart your own book with the help of an experienced editor and putting it back in such a way that the tension changes completely. And sometimes it's a really simple thing, you know, it's putting in a very short chapter in between two longer ones, it's varying the sentence length, it's taking a break from a narrative thread at a moment of high tension and going across to another one that's working at a slightly different pace, so that the reader is sort of frustrated by the change in story and wanting to get back to the sort of the original one. So there are lots of things that I'd learned that perhaps I'd read about but hadn't really made sense to me until I did it myself.
And did the story, you started off with thinking that you wanted to write something a little bit darker. And I think there was a particular case back in Bristol, a hit and run that was on your mind when you first started as a police officer, there you go, detective, police officer. And you've just referred also to your own loss in your family. And you talk about grief being one of those topics that, because it can become all consuming, was part of your ideas going into the book. Did those themes survive the rewrite? Were they enhanced by it?
Yes, absolutely. I think the themes, I probably wasn't really aware of the themes when I started writing I Let You Go. There were things I wanted to explore, as you say, that there was a hit and run that had just left me with questions. You know, why does someone drive off from a hit and run? What goes through their head? How does that change you as a person? How do you live with that? So lots of questions. And, you know, my own bereavement was very fresh, and I was acutely aware of how trauma and tragedy change you as a person. So I was sort of exploring those, but they definitely came out. They came to the fore in the editing process when perhaps I would look at them almost in isolation and look at how I was reflecting those in the book, what metaphors I was using, how the landscape I was describing was mirroring the emotions that were being explored in a particular character. And that sort of level of detail, I'm sure there are writers that can put that in a first or second draft. But for me, that's very much the sort of the colouring in that I might do after I've written the book a couple of times. Whereas now I'm probably a bit more aware of those themes earlier on. So I suspect I weave them in. Certainly my second book, I had four drafts on. So I'm sort of optimistic that perhaps my third book might just have two or three. And, you know, now I'm just about to start book three. There is a very strong theme of separation. I'm very aware of it. And so I suspect, again, that will be stronger from the outset. We're all learning all the time, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. So you signed a two-book deal with Little Brown, I think, when you sold I Let You Go. You've done your second book, I Can See You, I think. I haven't got it in front of me, but I think is your second. Is that right?
I see you.
Sorry. Deal extended, or have you done another deal with them? Or
I have signed another two-book deal with them, yeah.
Okay. And you've so very trad, which, as I say, is you know, fantastic. And it's the route we'd certainly recommend if it's open to you at the right price and so on. But is out of the corner of your eye, are you looking at the self-publishing world and wondering how that operates?
Out of the corner of my eye, only in the same way that I'm sort of looking at everything in the world around me out of the corner of my eye. It's not a route that I wanted to go down right at the start. It's not a route that at the moment I would consider, purely because I'm having a truly enjoyable and rewarding experience being traditionally published, both from a sort of a team point of view, from a financial point of view, from a career point of view, that there is nothing about my publishing journey that is not working for me. But equally, it's not something I would ever rule out. I'm hugely impressed by those who are self-published and doing it very, very well. There are, you know, a lot of books out there that are self-published and probably shouldn't be published, just as there are an awful lot of books that are traditionally published and perhaps shouldn't be. So I'd like to see a little bit more merging of the two camps. I think it's a little bit to them and us. And I don't like that very much. I think, you know, we're published authors and we've all got a lot to learn from each other. Mm. And I think it's a shame that the two camps are still rather divided.
I agree with that. And that's something that, the way I look at it is all we're doing is telling stories, and the means of delivery, that's the only difference. So you can either deliver it yourself by way of a platform like Amazon or Apple, or you can rely on a traditional publisher to take care of the distribution for you. So at the end of the day, it's providing interesting and exciting and engaging stories for readers. That's what we're aiming to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, a big part of my career, I suppose, is print. I'm a huge fan of digital, and my digital sales are very important. But for the moment, where I am is print. You know, being I Let You Go was a Sunday Times bestseller last year for 12 weeks. And that obviously is purely down to print sales, not to digital. So if I were to be self-published, that would be much, much harder to achieve. I'm sure, you know, you'll know far more than me about people that perhaps have achieved it. But I am hugely grateful to my publishing team, you know, who are out there putting me into WH Smith, putting me into supermarkets, into independent bookshops, into the hands of readers who are subsequently putting me in the Sunday Times top 10. And I would be very reluctant to walk away from that sort of strategy at the moment.
Yeah, that's something that, I mean, I noticed that before we met, actually, that it was impossible to go past a branch of Smith's without seeing a post in the window for the book. And then you go into the shelves, it's very prominently displayed, obviously selling an enormous amount of copies, which was great to see. And then you said about how things are, you know, things are coming apart, or things are still apart, but hopefully coming together. And that's where we met, wasn't it? We went to Apple. You hosted an event for some authors. And on the one hand, we had some traditional authors. And on the other hand, we had some self-publishers like me, and Joanna Penn was there.
Yeah.
And we got talking about just, I think we had a chat about Facebook ads, didn't we? And mailing lists and that kind of thing. So I mean, just talk a minute about how, because you run your mailing list yourself. This isn't something that is handed off to the publisher. This is something that you engage with yourself, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I do take quite a lot of control of my career. I feel very strongly this is my career, not somebody else's. It's not something that's being done to me. And so my mailing list is mine. I encourage people to sign up for my book club. I send a quarterly newsletter. I make that newsletter informative, entertaining, useful, not just a sort of a promotional tool. It has so my approach is very much like the extra DVD that you might get in a box set, you know, the behind the scenes stuff, the deleted scenes. So I will send out deleted scenes from I Let You Go, you know, scenes that I cut because for whatever reason they weren't needed, or an extra short story, or, you know, so something, or video interviews that is actually worthwhile someone signing up. That's very much under my control. My social media strategy has always been very sort of clear. I set myself goals. I look at how I'm going to achieve them, and I check how I'm doing every sort of 3 months. So I think what I'm saying is I would quite enjoy the elements of self-publishing that I do at the moment, the marketing side. I'm just not quite sure I'd want to leap into it wholeheartedly.
So how do you, I mean, talk about your mailing list. So how do you build that? Is it, you have a call to action in the back of the books?
I do. So, I mean, that's an area where I know a lot of self-published authors are incredibly strong, and I'm sort of watching and learning all the time. I have a clickable link from my ebooks, which goes to my book club page. It also appears in the back of my print books. It's on all my promotional bookmarks, postcards, you know, anything like that that's produced. And that's both in the UK and in the States. So, for example, I'm just looking on my desk at a full page advert that my US publishers took out in the New York Times, which has my web link at the bottom.
Nice.
So those sorts of things work really well. Just before a newsletter, when I know what the content is likely to be in it, I will do a Facebook advert and a call to action there. I'll do giveaways. Twitter works very, very strongly for me for signups. It's an area that I can still do. There's a lot more I can do, and it's sort of on my list.
Your to-do list. I don't want to pry, but does your deal take account of the fact that you do a lot of the marketing? You're certainly doing a lot of the front-end digital marketing for the books.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard thing to quantify, but I would say yes. I think actually it does for any deal nowadays. I remember the very first meeting I had with my acquiring editor, so just at the point where she was deciding whether or not to offer on my first deal. And I remember being taken aback that I was asked as much about me and my contacts, my plans, my social media, my online presence, my sort of marketing savvy, as I was about my writing and this book. And it just brought home to me that when traditional publishers are considering a deal, they're looking at you as a package. They're looking at what you can offer as a career author. They're not just looking at your book. And so I think that first deal certainly, you know, was about me as a person as well as me as a book. And yes, you know, going forward, once my publishers had worked with me for 18 months, it was very clear, you know, they knew how I worked, they knew what I was capable of. Yeah, they knew how I worked, and they liked it, and I liked working with them. And, you know, it's definitely part of the deal.
So when you at that stage, what kind of, I mean, I think I've seen it described as, what's your platform like? You know, what's your, yeah, you know, your Twitter presence, Facebook, all that kind of stuff. What kind of level were you at that stage? Did you have, if you had followers, or you at the beginning stage?
Yeah, I did. In fact, somewhere I will have somewhere my social media strategy sort of for that particular period, which will tell me exactly how many followers I had and what I was aiming to achieve over the next quarter. I had to change slightly because earlier when we mentioned my mediocre chick-lit book, I had written this excellent romantic comedy. And at the time, I was doing freelance journalism. I was writing funny stuff. I was writing a very funny blog and wrote this romantic comedy. My whole strategy was around building the sort of audience that read those sorts of books. When I switched, I had to rebrand, essentially. So I had to change my name. I was writing under a different name. I had to gradually sort of slide my social media activity over from the sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek, self-deprecating, stay-at-home mum type content over to a slightly more thoughtful, more sinister content. And that took time. That took about 12 months. So in a way, it was good that I had this long editing process after I got my deal, because I needed to handle all of that. And rather than, I mean, I still follow a lot of rom-com authors and readers, and there is a very strong crossover actually between the two genres. So it's not quite as distinct as perhaps moving from science fiction or fantasy to, I don't know, to crime or to comedy. But I had to do that and focus on building the sort of audience that I wanted for this particular genre of writing.
Yeah, I'm just looking at your Facebook page now, actually. It's really good. A lot of really excellent content. So, I mean, I've just seen there's a, you've posted a photograph of an idea for a book, just something that you've written in the back of a you know, spiral-bound notebook or something.
Yeah, that was the very first idea for I Let You Go.
That's great. All that kind of content, readers absolutely love that. It establishes a connection between the reader and the writer. I think that's really excellent and so easy to do. It's so easy to make that kind of content available these days, and you get really tangible results from it.
Yeah, you do. I'm a huge fan of Facebook, and I don't have a huge following there. I've got about 1500, 1600 followers on Facebook, but they are incredibly engaged. And so my reach is very high. So my reach from a post might be perhaps 10,000, maybe 20,000 from quite a small number of people, just because there's a lot of engagement, a lot of commenting, a lot of sharing.
Yeah.
So it's very useful to me as a promotional tool, but it's also the area I enjoy most. I have some sort of genuine conversations with readers. I use them a lot for research and for ideas. You know, if I'm stuck with a character name, or they were very helpful in identifying a view from, I'd worked out a penthouse that I wanted, a London penthouse I wanted in my book, and I had the view from the terrace, but I'm not a Londoner. I don't know where all these places are, but my Facebook followers do. And so those sorts of things are genuinely useful. And of course, mixed in with that is some of the sort of the sharing of more promotional activities, you know, books being for sale or on special offer. But mostly I consider Facebook to be my sort of social environment where I get to chat to readers.
Are you more of a Facebook than Twitter person?
I'm both and really equally enthusiastic, just for different purposes. And so Twitter is more, you know, I chat more generally about it with a wider group of people. So a lot of non-readers. I would say that probably everybody on my Facebook page has read my book, whereas most of the people who follow me on Twitter perhaps haven't. You know, it's a very different mix of people. So I use them for different things. I tend to be a lot more visual with Facebook and have more protracted conversations, whereas Twitter is much more dynamic. I share a lot of content that is related to more sort of personal interests, a lot of news articles, those sorts of things that wouldn't be appropriate on my Facebook page. I'm deeply averse to sharing the same content across lots of social media platforms unless it genuinely works on all those platforms. So something that fills me with horror is when I see social media advisors or consultants recommending that people use something like Hootsuite to just throw out the same content across all your platforms, because it shows no understanding of how those platforms work individually, or how the timings might work, or, you know, the audiences might be different. And so I think it's rather bad advice.
Yeah, I mean, the content needs to be native, by which I mean it needs to fit in with what people would expect to find on those platforms. So
absolutely.
Snippets of conversation on Twitter, more in-depth, you know, and articles and photographs and visual things on Facebook.
Absolutely. And it may be that you share the same thing, but in a different way.
Yeah, for the platforms. I noticed you're giving a course in France later in the year for crime writers. Is there a non-fiction, non-writing income stream opening up for you? Is that something you see in your future?
Do you know what? It's oddly enough, I was thinking about this morning. It's actually something I want to wind down or need to wind down, because I just don't, I don't have the time to do it. So I am doing this course, and I'm doing it because Chez Castillon is just the most beautiful, beautiful place in southwest France. And I've spent many happy retreats there where I've got a phenomenal number of words written. And so it's a joy to go and run a course. But no, my life is very, very full of writing and the promotional activity that accompanies books, as you know, is phenomenal. And so at the moment, I am supporting the release of I Let You Go in the States. So it's only been out now for 2 weeks. There's a lot of interviews and blog posts and just general stuff that needs to be done. I'm gearing up to the release of I See You in the UK. And so I've got dinners with print reviewers. I've got visits with sales reps, going out to bookshops. So a lot of pre-promotional activity. And then that's only going to build in July when the book comes out. I've got a lot of literary festivals and signings and other events. And in between all of that, obviously need to write my third book. So I just don't have time to do the sorts of workshops and journalism that perhaps I used to.
Claire, could I ask you just look at how your typical day plays out? So in terms of the split between writing on the one hand and promotion and marketing on the other, what does your day look like?
There is no typical day, really. Today should be a writing day. I'm just at the start of book three, and I should really be able to get 1,000 or 2,000 words written. I always start off the same way. I did the dog walk and the school run, and then I'm back at my desk by about 10 o'clock. We had this podcast scheduled for 11. And so actually what I managed to do between 10 and 11 was get a few emails done, you know, all book related stuff, saying yes to interviews, responding to US publicists who are sharing information, a couple of foreign deals that have come in that I'm saying yes, great, fantastic to. So lots of those sorts of things. We've got this podcast now. I've got a lunch with a TV producer who's interested in putting I Let You Go on the screen. I will get probably an hour, maybe 2 hours work in this afternoon. I've got to prep for an interview that I'm doing with L.S. Hilton, who wrote Maestra, tonight. So I might, if I'm lucky, get an hour's writing in, which will probably, for me, equate to about 500 or 600 words. So not hugely productive in terms of words, but a proper busy working day nevertheless.
Now we feel very guilty and also very grateful for taking some time to talk to us this morning. How old are your children?
9, 8, and 8.
Okay, so and they get back from school, then I guess it's back into mum mode?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, they're very good. They're very self-sufficient. And if I'm on deadline, then they pretty much fend for themselves, and they will, you know, they know to forage if they need feeding. So mostly I do try and stop at 4 o'clock when they come home. But I'm not very good at switching off. So occasionally I will just push on through.
That's something that I definitely, I'm with you on that one. It is difficult to switch off sometimes. I mean, my kids are 4 and 2, so it's...
Oh, that's hard work. They're still quite needy, aren't they, at that age? Oh, quite rightly so.
They are. My son's just getting over chicken pox, so he's very cuddly at the moment. So.
I secretly quite like it when my children are ill. I know that sounds awful. It's not from a kind of Munchausen's kind of way, but just because they become so cuddly and quiet and soft and just delicious.
You need to train them in foraging, Mark, so they can start going out.
They can roam free, exactly.
Yeah, so you're over there in the Cotswolds, I believe, Claire, is that right? So you've got some nice...
I am, in Chipping Norton, not part of the Chipping Norton set.
Not part of the Chippy set. So Jeremy Clarkson's not your neighbour.
He is
your neighbour. You just don't go for dinner very often.
No, kitchen suppers are not something I get invited to.
So you've got your two books, obviously, and I See You is your second, working on your third. Are you now set in a sort of pattern of the darker side, you know, with crime and aspects of crime being very much a part of the way you're going to write? Do you see yourself perhaps moving genres at any point? Is chick lit ever going to come back onto the horizon?
No, I don't think it will actually. I'm a big advocate of chick lit, of commercial women's fiction, of it should be called, because it's fun and enjoyable and, you know, quite escapist. But I think for the time being, darker is where I'm at. Psychological thrillers are satisfying for me to read, and they're satisfying to write and challenging to write. So yes, definitely for the moment, there's a book I want to write that isn't a thriller, doesn't have a crime element. I'm not quite sure. I think it's probably, I think you would call it high concept commercial fiction. And at some point I will write that. But for now, I'm firmly rooted in the crime world.
Okay, now we should say you're on Twitter as Claire McIntosh with a zero instead of the O, at Claire. Yes. McIntosh. So you've just replaced the O with a zero. Obviously,
on Facebook, it's Claire Mac Writes.
Yes, I've broken one of the golden rules, of course, of your social media platforms, which is to make sure they're consistent across every platform. So I apologise.
You're famous enough now that a Google of Claire McIntosh will reveal all of these things.
You can't escape me. I'm everywhere.
Claire, it's been really interesting talking to you. I think particularly about the initial journey that you took from writing a book to turning it into the book that got sold. And I think that, you know, whether you're doing that by yourself or you've got the I would say the luxury or the experience of having a very, very experienced literary agent and editor with you or not, that's definitely something I'm thinking about in terms of writing, about the drafting and the redrafting and then finding a way of making those themes come through, which is what the book's all about. The story is just a vessel, really, isn't it, for those themes you leave people with?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I found that really interesting. Thank you very much indeed from your very busy life. I hope your children presumably are at school rather than foraging for food in the garden.
They are indeed at school, but it was a real pleasure to talk to you both. I was delighted to be invited and it's been lovely to chat.
Claire McIntosh. So fantastic for her. Really pleased that she's having this success. And she talked about trying to break America, and we'll find out in due course from her how she's getting on with that. It's been a slower start than she'd experienced in the United Kingdom, but I have no doubt she's going to be big around the world. And very happy with her traditional deal. I mean, we didn't really push her on that. And I felt a little bit like we were talking to somebody who had felt she'd done everything right by getting this amazing publishing deal. And yet I sense the world is moving towards, certainly from a commercial point of view, and we can think of one or two of our own students who've probably sold fewer books but made more money, to a different way of doing things. But it's not for everybody. And for Claire, this is a perfect fit for her, isn't it?
Yeah, she's done amazingly well. But the latest author earnings report was out this week, and it made it very, very clear from the analysis of Amazon's data that authors who have started in the last 5 years are much, much more likely to make a significant living, or kind of a living, really, by self-publishing rather than traditional publishing. The odds are much more in their favour that way. But yeah, sure, it's not for everyone. Claire's done amazingly well. She's got, you know, got a great agent, got a great publisher. They've knocked it out of the park as far as marketing her has gone. So why would she be interested in changing? There's no reason at all why she should. But my advice would still typically be, I think for most writers, is to at least look carefully at self-publishing, because even at kind of the base level, 70% royalty as opposed to 10 or 12% royalty is going to look quite a bit more attractive if you start selling a good number of books.
Right. And talking of selling books, we should say that time is running out if people do want to buy into Mark's premium course, Facebook Ads for Authors, which is wrapped up with Twitter Ads for Authors, and on the way down, YouTube Ads for Authors. We're in the last few hours and days, aren't we, of this launch?
Yeah, we close the carts. It will either be on the 13th of June or when we hit the limit for the students we feel comfortable accommodating this time, which might happen over the weekend, possibly. So if people are interested, then they should go over to the site at selfpublishingformula.com. There's a banner there you can click to go and have a look at the sales page, which has testimonials, details on the course, a video from me talking about what students can expect to find inside. And if there are any questions people have, then they can drop us a line at support@selfpublishingformula.com, and it will come to me if necessary, or you, James, or John can handle those too. So plenty of ways for people to get in touch with us.
Yes, and don't forget Alexandra, who's also part of the SPF team, and may answer your emails. Okay, that's great. We've got more work to do over the next few days, and then we've got hundreds of students who are going to be taking their first steps, or maybe their first advanced steps, in Facebook advertising and so on over the next few weeks. So loads of good interviews and topics still to come on the podcast every Friday. Don't hesitate if you want to contact us, particularly if there's a subject area you would like to hear us talking about, or an interview you'd like to hear. You can always email us, support@selfpublishingformula.com. And we'll see you next time, when we will be well rested.
It will be the week before I go on holiday. So I'll be looking forward to being well rested.
You've been listening to the Self Publishing Formula podcast. Visit us at selfpublishingformula.com for more information, show notes, and links on today's topics. You can also sign up for our free video series on using Facebook ads to grow your mailing list. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. We'll see you next time.